This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Amy Carey, Executive Director of Sound Action, an environmental watchdog group dedicated to protecting the health of Puget Sound's nearshore habitats and species. Amy Carey is here today to tell us about the work of Sound Action to ensure that the nearshore ecosystem is protected. Welcome, Amy.
Good to be here. Thank you for having us in.
Would you elaborate on the mission and goals of Sound Action?
Sure. On one hand, it's fairly simple. We have a pretty centralized mission of protecting nearshore habitat in Puget Sound. And the way that we do that is essentially acting as a watchdog organization for the nearshore permits that are issued for in-water development. So if it's in the water and it's a permit, we are taking a look at those. Right now, we have our focus on the state permits that are issued by the State Department of Fish and Wildlife under their hydraulic code. And we review those permits to make sure that they're protecting habitat as they're required to by law, and that the environmental laws that are already out there and on the books are being applied appropriately, so that first and foremost, we're protecting the habitat that's so critical to Puget Sound.
Would you like to say a few words about the history of Sound Action?
We have a bit of an interesting history in that while we're an officially newer group that launched as Sound Action in 2013, just about a year ago, we actually have quite a bit of history behind us. We were born from the organization that was called Preserve Our Islands, that was initially founded in, I think it was 1997, as a smaller community group on Vashon Mori Island that came together when there was a threat that came forward from a multinational foreign-owned mining company to create what, per the extraction rates, would have been the largest sand and gravel mine in the country on the shoreline of Mori Island, which is, for folks who might not be from the area, and even some folks in the area, is just about a 20-minute boat ride from Seattle, an island in itself, and it's an aquatic reserve, and just an amazing habitat for orcas, forage fish, salmon. So Preserve Our Island spent about 13 years, actually, before we finally closed it out, fighting against that proposal and against sort of all odds. And I think as we clearly proved ourselves to have a great amount of tenacity and a lot of science know-how, we won that fight. And so now we have this mile of shoreline and hundreds of acres that are protected. We effectively acted as a regulatory watchdog through that whole process with the permits. And it's where we learned a lot that's informed the work we do now of how very broken the permitting regulatory system is. In that case, you had a project that clearly should not have been given any green light, and yet it was at every turn. And ultimately, we prevailed in that when we overturned the project in federal court under an Endangered Species Act litigation. And when we won that fight, we certainly could have said, hey, great job, and sort of packed it in and everybody gone back to normal life. But by that time, it was a regional fight at that point, and we had developed lots of great partnerships with environmental organizations and other elected officials. And we really had a know-how in us to do some certain work that wasn't being done in Puget Sound. And so instead of just packing up, we moved forward and blossomed and became a regional Puget Sound-wide environmental group. So our board of directors now has, we have representatives from all throughout Puget Sound, North Sound, West Sound, South Sound, and again stepped forward to fill what we could see was clearly a gap of acting as a regulatory watchdog for development in Puget Sound.
What are some of the other groups that you work with?
You know, the Puget Sound region is incredibly fortunate to have some really, really amazing groups doing really great work. We have had great long-term relationships, both as Preserve Our Islands and as we move forward. We certainly have groups like the Washington Environmental Council that do really astounding work and that have taken up at least the mantle of the People for Puget Sound work, because clearly that was a gap. When People for Puget Sound, the organization, closed, they had been longtime partners. FutureWise does phenomenal work working in the regulatory fields with more localized shoreline management plans. There's groups like Puget Sound Keeper who do watchdogging with water quality. Sierra Club, Audubon, Wild Fish Conservancy. We feel really fortunate to have these really great organizations to collaborate with and partner with as we all try to strive towards our common goal of saving Puget Sound.
Would you give us an overview of the current health of Puget Sound?
Not good. that's the short answer. It's pretty clear that while we'll all talk about how, you know, Puget Sound is just astoundingly beautiful from above, but you get below the surface and it's a very different story. And to put it very frankly, Puget Sound is dying. And every indicator that we look at, whether it's forage fish or intact beaches, eelgrass, different macroalgae vegetations, are all in just incredibly imperiled states of decline. We have herring populations that certainly overall have a 40% decline since the 70s. Cherry Point herring stock is at a 90% decline. Chinook populations at 10% of historic levels. And orcas are iconic, beloved sort of Puget Sound mascot species. Their population decline is terrifying, really, when you think about what could happen. There's 80 whales left out of what scientists and researchers expect there probably had been 200 or more. But even when you look at more recent declines there, since 2005 when they were listed, there's been a 10% decline in population. In the past 2 years, a 5% decline in their population. So we really look at the very critical state that Puget Sound is, and unless there is significant change immediately, we will lose Puget Sound.
What are the key threats to the health of Puget Sound?
Habitat loss. I think that that is the starting point. There's certainly other, you know, complexities of when we look at climate change and acidification, and those are some tricky things to kind of wrap your head around the solutions for it. But the very no-brainer obvious is that we have habitat loss. And unless we stop habitat loss in the nearshore areas, again, we will not win this fight for Puget Sound. You cannot restore faster than what's being lost right now. And what that comes back to and why our work is focused on the regulatory issues is this habitat loss is occurring at the hands of the regulatory agencies who were designed and put in place. They're supposed to have the mandatory responsibility of protecting it, and that's not what's happening.
Has there been any progress made in protecting Puget Sound?
Well, I think there's certainly some good work going on in all sorts of corners of Puget Sound and some really fabulous restoration projects. You know, when we moved forward and we were looking at what our new name was going to be, we were very clear that action was not just a word in a title. It's actually what we do. And I think that that's a lot of what we need to see. There's great studies out there and they sit up on a shelf. And unless as a region, as a community, both elected regulatory bodies and even citizens, unless we actually start taking some very targeted actions, we will not see recovery. We're not seeing recovery. When you have the State of the Sound reports that will come out from the Puget Sound Partnership every year, and granted, these things take time. Nobody expects that, you know, next week everything's hunky-dory. But when you're seeing things still move the other way, and what we see, particularly in our permit-by-permit review, we see how that's clear that unless you make some changes and stop allowing that habitat loss, stop allowing every bulkhead, every dock, every marina, you're not going to catch up with the damage that has been occurring over past decades.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Amy Carey, Executive Director of Sound Action, an environmental watchdog group dedicated to protecting the health of Puget Sound's nearshore habitats and species. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM, and on the web at kexp.org. What do you see as the main reasons that we haven't been making more progress in protecting Puget Sound?
I think very clearly one of the main reasons is the failure of the regulatory system. Every development project that goes forward has to have a permit. And again, we focus at the state level because any project in Puget Sound requires an HPA, so it's a way to sort of centralize and look and see what's going on. And what we see over and over, and at this point, we review every single HPA permit that comes through, and that might be 500-600 a year. We've been doing that for not quite a year. So we have kind of unique, I think, information in front of us as to what's really happening there. And what we see is every single permit approved. We don't see any project denied. And we see projects that are being approved that are allowing habitat loss. Sometimes it's as simple as projects that are proposed, and when they're issuing the permits, they don't put the simplest protective measures there for protecting forage fish from construction impacts. And they're allowing docks into herring and over eelgrass and macroalgae. So it goes back to the death by a thousand cuts. We see it every day with each permit that we're reviewing. And some of those cuts are bigger. Some of them are proposals for, coal exports and things that have different levels of impact. But we've clearly seen the result of that. We've had environmental laws on the books for decades, 30 years. We're seeing these declines during this process. And I think it really comes down to, unless as our regulatory bodies and again our communities and our legislatures get a bit of some backbone, we need to learn to say no. I realize that sounds simplified, but it's true that until we can really have our regulatory bodies applying the law, we're not going to see improvement unless we stop that habitat loss through that venue.
Well, you're focused on the nearshore habitat for protection. What is the importance of the nearshore habitat to the health of Puget Sound?
The nearshore is the breadbasket, the base, the everything of Puget Sound. It's where the bottom of your food chain is starting, whether it's in the tiny microscopics. Certainly, you can even go to the level of what we can see of the forage fish. So the tiny fish, it's sort of an amazing thing to think that all of Puget Sound, that the health of it to some degree rests on the health of tiny little fish that are, the size of your pinky. But the forage fish are what feed the salmon, and the salmon are what feed the orca, and then there's the everything in between. So if you have a collapse of your nearshore, you have a collapse of Puget Sound. And those habitats are pretty sensitive. Forage fish, whether it's the adult fish themselves, their spawning activities, the substrates that they need for spawning, the vegetations that they need are all there and are most directly impacted by nearshore development, whether that's a dock or a marina, bulkheads that have starved the beaches that they need so desperately.
You've alluded to this a bit earlier, but what is the status of the nearshore habitat in Puget Sound?
It's in decline. Again, when you look at the Puget Sound Partnership, and they'll put together sort of their dashboard indicators, and herring declines and the vegetation, eelgrass, macroalgae. Folks focus on eelgrass, which is important, but it's also really important to remember that herring particularly use a wide variety of substrates to spawn on, as do other creatures of the nearshore. And we're seeing declines in those areas. And we're seeing the declines even with restoration projects and even with studies and even with this. And that comes back to that taking action to actually put those studies into place, to put those laws applied onto the permits that are going forward. We see bulkheads, I think out of all of the impacts to nearshore, it's fairly clear that bulkheads themselves have such a tremendous impact. They starve the beaches, and particularly it's where some of the prime forage fish, the surf smelt and the sand lance, it's their exact spawning area and the substrates there. We see more bulkheads going in than are coming out. We lose nearshore every day in Puget Sound right now.
What fraction of the shoreline is covered by bulkheads, roughly?
I think that's a little hard to get the final number on. You'll have the partnership generally report. I think in this past report, it was somewhere along the lines of 800 miles out of the generalized 2,500, probably give or take, miles of Puget Sound that are armored and hard armored. And we're seeing that increase every year. There's certainly a concern that as we have climate change and likely sea level rise, you're going to have more bulkheads that somebody is proposing or even that they're trying to put in. So that's a clear impact, and I think everybody's recognized that it's something that needs to stop. But then we have this gap of the regulatory bodies are still approving these, just sort of green lighting going right through.
So what are the conditions that need to be fulfilled to have a permit to make a change in the nearshore?
Sadly, it's a pretty low hurdle. Again, you can look and see that virtually every regulatory body, whether it's the Army Corps of Engineers, because if you're doing in-water work in Puget Sound, you need federal permits. So whether it's the Army Corps of Engineers, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, or even then the local jurisdictions, they, in effect, do not deny any permits. And those can be for big or for small. They do have for example, at the in the hydraulic code that we work specifically with, there is a list of certain rules and sort of technical provisions that usually get applied to permits. They actually have a standard. Permits are not supposed to be permitted unless they meet the sort of mandated standard of no net loss.
Of habitat.
Of habitat. Yeah. Fairly simple statement. You know, no net loss. You cannot be losing nearshore. Now, that's not been what's happening. Again, you have every single permit being approved, and they're clearly not meeting a no net loss standard. That's very hard. There's really no way to have a bulkhead meet a no net loss standard. You can't mitigate away. And that's what we'll see the regulatory bodies kind of on paper, you know, sure, put a bulkhead in, but pull some debris out of the shoreline area, and that's no net loss. So we certainly have challenged that. There's simple things, timing restrictions that they're supposed to put on that are to protect species that are spawning, particularly juvenile salmonids when they're in migratory patterns and they're very small, herring when they're spawning, surf smelt, sand lance, different forage fish. They're supposed to have those conditions put on there that you're not allowed to do work in the water when those events are, we know generally when they're occurring. We find that the agencies rarely apply even those timing restrictions, the simplest of things. That is, check the box off, apply that to the permit, and they often are not applied. And part of our work as we review these permits, certainly there's the aspect of being informed of what's really going on, but we challenge them. So if we have permits that we're seeing issued that don't contain, whether it's the proper timing restrictions, they don't meet the no net loss standard, they maybe have been approved without a vegetation survey that's even been conducted, we appeal. So we file appeals on that with the state agency. There's a process there. And since we've been doing our sort of real-time review work, started really in about last October that we gained access to the daily permits as they come through, we've filed, I think, close to 60 appeals. And have seen change happen because of those.
You are attuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Amy Carey, Executive Director of Sound Action, an environmental watchdog group dedicated to protecting the health of Puget Sound's nearshore habitats and species. What has been the result of your efforts so far?
You know, we've seen a range of things. We certainly didn't expect that we'd suddenly have a state agency just handing everything over to us, as we said, or sort of bowing to what we said there. So we've really seen a range. And what we've chosen to do at the state level with Fish and Wildlife, they have a process there where you can file an informal appeal. You can also file a formal appeal should you choose to right away. But we're also trying to work in partnership with the department and support them and hopefully just be having some good dialogues and conversations. So we have to date chosen to go the informal process, which is still an appeal process, and there's hearings and information, but it gives you some better opportunity for dialogue. And we've also taken certainly the strategy of once we file the appeals, we will first reach out to the staff member at the department who was the one who signed the permit. And again, have some one-on-one with, here's what we're seeing, here's what we'd like, based on law, not just what we'd like, but here's what we'd like, need to see, based on what the statute says. And we've had some of those staff members, they're actually called the Area Habitat Biologists, AHBs. We've had some of them, on first response, say, thank you. I missed that. Thank you, I made it. There was an error there. And change the permit, modify it even before going to the appeal hearing and that sort of more involved process of it. We've had that. We've had the opposite. I've had a few stern conversations from some staff there, but we've been going through some of the appeal processes and some of them are still in the decision point. They take a while to have some of the decisions back and forth. So we've seen progress, certainly one-on-one with some of the permits. I'm confident, too, that we've seen progress both in developing a relationship and a dialogue with the department and hopefully at least making some incremental progress in what's been a pretty short time period, you know, 9 months or so, of really making that change, moving towards getting to that place where we have permits that are coming out that are proactive, that are first and foremost making sure habitat is protected, that say no when they need to say no. So we're making progress towards that front. Recognize big change like that doesn't happen overnight, but we're seeing good effects.
So do you catch the permits before the people have actually made the changes on the near shore?
Yeah, we do. So we see the permits as they're being issued right now. We review them, and by law, there's a 30-day period where you can file the appeals. So typically we do. Sometimes there are permits that go out. There might be emergency permits, or sometimes there's been one or two where the work was done very quickly. It was a smaller project, but for the most part, we do. And even if we're not seeing the permits fully modified or changed, what we're seeing is the benefit of, again, having the discussion with the department and really letting them know, too, we're watching. We've made it very clear to them in every conversation that even though we are now targeting the hydraulic code and taking a look at these permits and being pretty vocal with the problems that we see, our intention is not just to be bad-mouthing and beating up on the department. These are good people. We're trying to help them do a good and a better job in whatever mechanism that we can, whether that's having good dialogue with them, helping with some information, helping support policies that support them. The department's currently in the process of doing some proposed rulemaking to change all the rules for the hydraulic code. So we're having some interesting conversations there. But again, we're trying to work with them to hopefully support a joint effort in the recovery of Puget Sound.
How do you see your efforts developing in the future?
Well, I think we're going to continue to see this kind of progress that is sometimes hard won or hard fought, hard won, that we go through communicating with the department, communicating with other agencies and letting them know what we see, whether it's talking to the partnership, talking to our legislators, talking to different environmental groups and community groups about what we are really seeing and recognizing this problem is here. And unless we fix it, again, none of us are going to be successful. So we've clearly have some momentum on that front. And I think not only from the approach and from the information that we see sort of firsthand with all of the permits and really taking a science-based approach to it, we're afforded a level of conversation that I think is beneficial. One of our other real concerns, aside from losing habitat through the permits, is that we've recognized we really don't have a baseline of Puget Sound. There is not a comprehensive baseline of where these habitats are in the first place. So, you know, parallel track of what we're working on is supporting that. We've found, as just an example, often when we're going through the permits, and we have all the data sets from the department of studies that they might have done in the past, for example, forage fish spawning, and we put those up on our beautiful GIS mappings. And so when we have permits, we'll put the coordinate points on and see what's going on here. And we'll go out and do site evaluations ourselves as well. But what we started to see pretty quickly, too, is that, for example, forage fish spawning, again, estimate of 2,500 miles of beach in Puget Sound. Of the historic surveys that have been done for documenting where these fish, which generally spawn everywhere, but where exactly they're spawning, there's been about 100 miles surveyed, physical survey. And we would see the department, rather than take a proactive approach if they had a permit come in and they didn't know because they had never looked there, they would say, well, there's no spawning there, and they would not put any protective provisions on for protecting that habitat. So we've had some interesting conversations of, if you haven't looked, that doesn't mean it's not there. So at the same time we're having these challenges, we're also trying to work on the solution of, let's take a look, shall we? And in fact, this year, the department just announced this week a project that we helped develop with them in the South Puget Sound region of really stepping up efforts using the Puget Sound Corps and working with the Department of Natural Resources to get some on-the-ground, very comprehensive surveys of forage fish and nearshore habitat. So it's another angle of the work that we do and moving things forward and taking action. Instead of talking about this, let's actually do it. Let's get some boots on the ground.
Again, could you give us a sense of the types of projects that are being affected by these permits, from smallest to largest?
We see the common things, bulkhead permits, dock permits, mooring buoys, marinas, marina expansions, dredging. Some of it we see a bit more infrequently, you know, ferry maintenance, things like that. And a lot of the permits, certainly a certain body of them, are repair work. Somebody had a bulkhead that they need to repair, or they might have had a dock, an overwater structure, we'll call it, that needs some repair. Some of the permits are that, but a pretty significant amount are also brand new. Just as a snapshot of the past sort of 30-day increment, we just filed an appeal this last week on about 10 new permits. I think there were three on that were brand new docks, brand new 200-foot overwater dock structures. Each of the ones we appealed were in herring habitat. They were over macroalgae. There were floats attached to them and mooring buoys. These are the kind of things that we know there's damage. The department themselves knows that there's damage from these things. They shade out the vegetation. They interrupt juvenile salmonid spawning. They can decimate the sedimentation processes. And we're seeing these things get green-lighted thumbs up every day.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Protect nearshore habitat. You know, truly, the criticalness of protecting the habitat. And we talk a lot, at least within the organization of Sound Action and with some of our environmental partners, of getting to know. N-O. And if we're going to save Puget Sound, we do have to get there. We do have to say no to the continued shoreline hard armoring, no to the continued decimation in these projects that chip away at the health of Puget Sound.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Amy.
Thank you so much.
You are just listening to Amy Carey, Executive Director of Sound Action, an environmental watchdog group dedicated to protecting the health of Puget Sound's nearshore habitats and species. For more information, check on the web at soundaction.org. Again, that's soundaction.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.